A Milwaukee,
Wisconsin,
public school teacher under fire after she cut a 7-year-old girl's hair off in class. Only on 12 News, why the little girl says her teacher got so upset and how MPS officials are responding. Good evening, I'm Kathy Michaelby.
And I'm Terry Sater. Toya has the night off. A Milwaukee,
Wisconsin,
teacher is charged with disorderly conduct after punishing a first grader by cutting her hair. In a story you'll see only on 12 News, Nick Bohr is here live with the little girl's story in her own words, Nick.
And Terry Lamaya Kamen is angry, confused, and scared by the incident last week in which the apparently frustrated teacher cut one of her hair braids off after she wouldn't stop playing with them in class. 7-year-old Lamaya Kamen sports a few dozen braids, but one is conspicuously absent.
She told me to stop playing with it. And then cut it off and sent me back to my desk.
Lamaya is a first grader at Congress Elementary and says her teacher used a classroom scissors to cut off one of the braids after she absentmindedly kept playing with them.
Tell me how you play with your hair. Show me what that means.
I wasn't playing that loud doing this.
She says the teacher called her to the front of the room and cut it in front of the whole class.
What did you do?
I went to my desk and cried. And they was laughing. She threw it away. And she said, now what you gonna go home and tell your mama? And then I said, you cut off my hair.
Lamaya's mom was and is furious. She went to the school and confronted the teacher.
I said, well, you know, you cut a lot of her hair off. And then she was like, well, I do apologize. She said, but I was frustrated.
The MPS district says they're going through the disciplinary process with the teacher, who remains in class, though Lamaya has been moved to a different classroom by the principal.
The main thing is, from the heart of the principal, and also from me speaking for the district, we're very sorry that this happened.
Lamaya's mom appreciates the apology, but says the district should seriously question whether the teacher should keep her job.
Why would we want someone like that teaching our kids? We trust our kids, and you know, once they go to school, to be safe.
Milwaukee police investigated the case and referred it to the district attorney for possible physical or mental abuse of a child charges. When the district attorney's office decided not to file criminal charges, police this week issued the teacher a $175 ticket for disorderly conduct. Now, we tried to talk to the teacher today, but were unable to reach him.
Everybody, this is Brett, and I'm in my car, and let's see how this goes. It is beautiful in New Hampshire. So nice. If you're one of those people who have been, like, contemplating, oh, you know, should I join the Free State Project and move to New Hampshire? Well, you know, there seems like there's a lot of good things going on there, and it would certainly be a community where I would feel comfortable and make a lot of friends, but it's just so damn cold, and I don't like the snow. Listen, today is February 18th. It is like the weather is borderline tropical. Borderline tropical here. Of course, I should put the disclaimer that individual experiences may vary, and of course, it may snow 2 feet tomorrow. But today is nice, so let's focus on today and let's enjoy today. I'm on the highway right now. I'm driving from where I live in Manchester, which is towards the middle of the state, if you're interested in New Hampshire geography, towards the seacoast, which is about 25 miles east. Now, usually I just refer to that whole area, like 20 or so miles east of where I live, as the seacoast. Today, very excited on this beautiful day to be going to the actual seacoast. Like where the ocean meets the land part. I think what I'm going to do, just telling you about my plans, I think what I'm going to do is go to the 1A, you know, the route. It goes all the way. It's up in Maine, and it goes all the way to Key West, Florida. You know, it breaks up here and there. But it is the coastal route. And we've got about 20 miles of coast, I would say, here in New Hampshire, if you're interested in New Hampshire geography. And I might drive it today just because it's so nice. Beautiful. Boy, I'm on the highway. The sun is shining, so let's talk about some things. Okay, so last couple months I've been busy with a couple of new things professionally. Some experiences that I never really had before in my career with respect to the age group with whom I've been working. Most of the tutoring and teaching that I have done, most of the work with young people that I have done since I started, probably in the year 2000, has been with people who are high school age. There was a brief stint where I was what was called a behavior manager for a dorm of kids that were like 10 or 11 or 12. That was terrible, and that's also something that I'll talk about on the show in the near future. But, I mean, majority of my experience has been with high school kids. But for the last 2 months, I've been working with children, very young, elementary school-age children, between pretty much the ages of 6 and 9, 6 and 10. And it's been a very interesting, enlightening experience, and it's got me thinking about some new ideas and maybe some new areas for exploration on the show. So there was, up until a few days ago, a school for the gifted in New Hampshire called the Scholars Academy. It actually just closed because the people who are involved in running the school want to eventually convert the project and their effort into a charter school. And why not if the state will dangle... state will dangle some money for you to do that, you know, instead of growing this innovative, very not as, like, unschooled, child-centered environment as I would have liked to see when I first walked in there, but definitely a step in the right direction. Of course, you might remember that Kate Baker and I talked about the Scholars Academy in Keys, installment 3, Transition, and I'm actually thinking about having Kate back on the show to do a little rap about gifted education, or this classification of gifted. So, the beginning of January, I started doing these enrichment classes with the kids up at Scholars, and I'd go in the afternoon, and it would be all the kids that go to the school, and maybe some homeschool kids would come in as well to do these, like, 7 or 8 week classes. So, one of the classes that I was doing was called Secrets of Great Thinkers. Now, first of all, I have to say it was very interesting being back in the front of a classroom as the sort of authority figure. And I was really, like, trying to take myself out of the picture. Like I would get up. I used to be a teacher, and I do teach these SAT classes where I have to write on the board and answer questions. I am the teacher in those classes. But this was more of, like, this interactive, fun, light kind of activity. So I would try things like, you know, I'd go, instead of, I would still find myself at the front of the room, like, writing something on the board. And I had to go and, like, sit in a desk or sit at the table where the kids were sitting and just talk to them so I could get out of that, you know, I wouldn't say it's really a mindset, but a presentation of I'm in charge here. Like, I'm going to decide what happens here, because that's not how I wanted any of these things to run. So Secrets of Great Thinkers was really, you know, we touched a little bit on, like, logic. How could you prove something true? How could you spot specious arguments? I didn't use the word specious with them. But it really wound up focusing more on exercises related to breaking conventional thinking patterns. And, of course, in this case, because these kids are so young, it would be nice to be able to snap those patterns before they even fully form, you know, of getting stuck in that box, those thought traps, language traps, and, you know, have some innovative and exciting and creative ways to solve problems. So one of the exercises we did, I'm sorry, I change lanes a lot on the highway. I like to try all the lanes. One of the exercises that we did was called Seed Ideas. And seed ideas, this will sound silly, but I like seed ideas, okay? You come up with a problem. And I let one of the kids pick the problem. I said, you know, who has a problem, personal, related to, you know, your I didn't want to do family. I didn't want to, you know, say, who's having problems at home? Or, you know, could be anything from the personal level, basically up to all of humanity, the entire planet Earth, the country, whatever you want to do. Pick a problem. We're going to work on solving it. We're going to work on coming up with some kind of innovative, unconventional, never thought of before, never even, you know, new territory kind of solution to a problem. So one of the kids said, gas is too expensive. In fact, that was interesting. I do a lot of driving. Gas is too expensive. And the rent is too damn high. I hope you get that joke. But yeah, so I thought that was interesting. And I said, okay, well, let me give you some seeds. And what I had asked them to do beforehand was just write down one word, one thought on a piece of paper. Don't tell anybody what it is. And now, once we have a problem, I ask everybody to reveal what the words were. So, and I just randomly chose three of them. So we had monkey, which is fun, ketchup, and the other one I think was like a hammer or something. So, no, it was a nail. It was a nail. So nail, ketchup, monkey. And I said, these are the seeds. These are the ideas that we start with in solving the problem that gas is too expensive. So even though these kids are highly creative and very imaginative and, you know, very individualistic, I found it interesting how narrow the initial ideas were, even in these wonderful little minds. Because it's like, well, can you put ketchup in a gas tank? Can you use monkey sweat as gas? Can you melt nails and put it in a gas tank? And I said, well, look, here's what we already have, kids. Like, we have these cars, they have these tanks, people put stuff in it, right? So that's like the conventional thinking. So let's expand. Let's go someplace new. Let's try something different. Let's see where these ideas can take us, right? So maybe monkeys leads us to bananas, and it's very much becomes like this path towards a solution where we can go all these interesting different places, and it's really a way to open up the thought process to new, exciting, and even, you know, honestly entertaining ways to look at problems and explore possible solutions. So what I had said was, I said, we call these seed ideas because the place we're at the end isn't anything like what we started with. I need a video camera. I talk so much with my hands that maybe, can you hear them? So yeah, all right. The seed doesn't look anything like what eventually comes out of it. What it eventually becomes. An apple seed doesn't look anything like an apple tree, right? A seed grows into something much larger. And then, oh man, the more, you know, I remembered saying that, and I started thinking about the last show and how I kind of snipped it up a little bit there at the end and at the beginning, so I was worried that there might have been a lack of clarity with how, you know, maybe some of these ideas about youth are passed from one generation to the next. And this whole seed into something else, you know, like not always a good thing. And, you know, when it comes to childhood or the way children are treated, the way children are raised, the seed could be that grows into something much larger and much different and perhaps more dire could be, what does mom or dad do when baby cries? You know, it could be something that simple at the starting point. But my whole career, I've worked with people in very small groups. Largest class I ever taught, I think, had 15 people in it. But usually, most of the stuff I've done, especially in the last 5 years, is one-on-one. And the work with these elementary school kids has either been one-on-one or in very small groups, and you can really see something. I think I can see something. I have a vantage point that people who are maybe public school teachers or adults or parents don't have. Of course, parents are not very involved in their child's academics. They kind of expect the kid will go to school, the teacher will teach them stuff, they come home, they do some homework. Maybe I do a meeting, I come in and I look at a painting, at a parent-teacher night or something that Stevie did. That sounds sad, but I think that most parents don't have that much involvement in their children's education, certainly not what I believe they should have compared to the control the state has over it. So I feel like I've been able to see, or I've had exposure to, you know, it's not some special ability that I have, because I've worked in these situations, I have been able to get a closer look at some of the feelings, some of the frustration, I guess I would say, that especially these young kids, especially these really bright kids have. So another important part of this class was like, it's okay to fail. And a lot of them had really, really difficult times if they were not successful doing something. It would be really, really upsetting for them if they couldn't be successful immediately. They couldn't get something immediately. They didn't understand something immediately. You know, that's not something that you deal with high school kids, because high school kids will not show you their emotions. And I don't always think it's because they've learned how to manage them better, but they've certainly learned how to hide them better, right? They've certainly learned how to put the cap on that bottle a little bit tighter. You know, I walk into these schools. I spend time in schools. I go in at the end of the day. I go in sometimes for meetings. I go in sometimes to drop off literature for SAT classes. Kids in school, if you could see like a top-down view, like a Legend of Zelda, the original Legend of Zelda, the great, great game, The Legend of Zelda, from the top-down view, these kids in this building, this environment, it just looks like fluid moving through a tube, right? There's no life to it. There's no interpersonal interaction. There's no real connection between children and adults. They're just going to the next place, you know, herded from here to there. You know, I've used the factory, the assembly line analogies plenty of times, so you get the idea. But as I walked into this elementary school to meet with this 6 or 7 year old girl a week ago, and it's the end of the day, the bell rings, and you just was like, you know, like, and the hallway just fills like some kind of machine, you know, and it's, I don't know how to describe it. I think you can kind of get the idea of what I'm saying, but there's no life. It's just routine. And then, you know, there's 20, 30 kids packed into a class. Maybe that is one place where I would agree with the teachers union, even though for totally different reasons, where they say, oh, we can do education better if we have smaller classes, which means that, you know, if the student to teacher ratio is cut down, it means more teachers can be hired and more people can pay union dues. But I really think that there's, I don't see a lot of really meaningful, really beneficial connections between young people and adults in these buildings. And I think that maybe it even becomes so routine for the teachers that they don't think about it. And maybe it's just the parents are completely unaware of it. So there's no time for like individuality. There's no time for personality. There's no time for individual issues. I mean, the school will pay lip service to these things. Like when you go in for a meeting, I've been to a lot of these meetings and it's pretty much all the same thing. We have, you know, these people who know how to speak this language, who know how to talk the talk. I think a lot of times they want to do the right thing, but they're just shackled in so many ways by procedures and process and that bureaucratic rat hole that they're in. Here's a little aside, but over the last year, through some connections that I have in this this tutoring business, I've done some contract work for some other companies, companies that are larger than mine, companies that, just as a contractor, that are basically franchises. So a lot of them are very, very popular. They get a lot of clients. They're spread out all over New England, if not beyond. I'm not going to say the name, but I've done a fair amount of contract work for this company over the course of the last year. Now, this company, this particular franchise, you know, and many others, were basically built over the last 10 years on top of government money, on top of taxpayer money. And here's how that happened. They were basically, well, All right, long story short. Long, shitty, boring story short and hopefully somewhat exciting. Maybe not exciting. When the No Child Left Behind law went into effect, there were these new procedures where kids who were lagging behind, specifically in the areas of math and reading, were going to get free tutoring from their district. So federal money was allocated for this. Some state money, I believe, was allocated for this. And money from the district was allocated for the purpose of tutoring these kids. Now, I've worked for a couple different franchises of this company, and in four over the past year and a half, I've done some side work for four different franchises of this company. And I was initially very surprised by how bureaucratic the culture, how bureaucratic the operation of this company was with paperwork and guidelines and, you know, following really strict and kind of arbitrary and cumbersome procedures for certain things. But, you know, that's the kind of system, that's the kind of culture that comes with taking money from the government. Now, years ago, I used to do the No Child Left Behind tutoring when I worked for another company that was not this company. It was just a company that was based in eastern Massachusetts. This is where my tutoring career began in like 2006. So I had a little bit of a different mindset then, so I wasn't so opposed to just, you know, wasting my time and kids' time and people's money to do this NCLB tutoring, which is, like, just excruciating. But over the past decade, tens if not hundreds of thousands of students have qualified for this tutoring. Now, these contracts go out to the company from the district, and tutors come in, and the district pays them. Now, when I was doing it, I was making $35 an hour, which means that the company was probably billing $50 or $60 an hour. And these students were getting sometimes 3 hours of this tutoring a week. So, and for no measurable results, no measurable improvements over the last decade since this was all implemented. Now, you take that into the school, into the culture of government school, and you think about how people get into that profession because they want to, you know, make a positive difference, right? They want to be an inspirational figure. But then they are just so constrained by procedure. I don't want to make it sound like school is just filled with a bunch of people who are, you know, impersonal and incompetent and disinterested in, you know, the young people that they supposedly serve, but the environment kind of forces that. The environment creates, and I know that feeling. You know, I know that feeling of like, oh, why would I go, why would I put in any extra effort? Why would I really care? You know, I'm limited in everything I can do. If I do this, I'm going to get in trouble. So most of these people are just kind of going through the motions I've found in these meetings. And beyond these meetings, really. Now, this has been kind of a rant, but maybe I can make it serve a purpose in this podcast. We're getting a little rain now, too, if you're interested in New Hampshire weather updates. Now, I look at all of the people that I have worked with and interacted with in the past in this profession, which includes public school teachers, private school teachers, public and private administrators, guidance counselors, other tutors, people who ran tutoring companies. And I realized something that initially was very startling, but in recent years I've kind of unfortunately gotten used to it. All of these limitations, all of these constraints, all of these molds and these boxes, these detours and U-turns that people encounter if they ever try to assert themselves as individuals or professionals. It's not just that nobody cares. It's not just that people, most people in this profession aren't having conversations like, oh, you know, I want to do innovative things. I want to do exciting things. I want to spark up these kids' interest in this stuff, but I just can't because of all these limitations that are placed on me. That conversation is not happening on any kind of significant scale. What's amazing to me is that people don't even seem to notice. the box that they're in this profession and in other professions, because by the time we become adults, all of these limitations, all of this pushing somebody into this mold, well, it's status quo. We've had a lot of preparation to live like that, to view other people as big and significant, and ourselves as small and insignificant, awaiting instructions from big people. I started working in education in the year 2000. I was a dorm staff, started working with kids, I should say, at a residential school in the year 2000. And I was called a residential counselor. And I realized that my job was essentially to crush the will of individuals. When these teenagers, many of whom were very bright, very creative, very individualistic, and those kinds of behaviors first landed them in trouble in school, and then, that starts you down the path to juvenile delinquent. The first step is, arms and legs and mind start popping out of that little mold that we're stuffed into in school, and then, it's just a slippery slope to juvenile delinquency. So we had a lot of those kids. I mean, the school had a very, very mixed and diverse population. Some of these kids were just, gangbangers. But I remember this one kid. His name was Matt. Matt was like 17. No, he was a big, tall, bulky kid. He had this voice. The first time I ever heard Seth Rogen, it reminded me, instantly took me back to this kid, Matt. He was really smart. He was really sharp. He was really witty. Highly individualistic. Played the guitar. Very creative. An adult, I was 21 when I started this job. What I didn't know at the time, I was pretty much still a kid. I was a senior in college. So I just finished 16 years of institutionalized schooling. And I was this little person awaiting instructions from big people. So this kid, Matt, who never hurt anybody, who was never a danger, never stole anything, when he would assert himself and say, "Why can't I do this? You know it's fine for me to do this." It was my job to tell him about the rules and the procedures and the chain of command at the school. And I mean, I realize that now. But, it took a while to figure that out. And that's what these hierarchical relationships so often are. These little insignificant people awaiting instructions, crushing the will of potentially great people. And this is going on even while nature is screaming at them. Like the case with this boy Matt that I'm talking about, throwing hair at his face. You are not a child anymore. And being in that adult body and having that adult intellect, in many cases, an intellect that might be superior to most adults that are imposing things on this young person. Well, boy, that's the setup to accept that kind of treatment for most people for the rest of their lives. I'm glad I could learn my way out of that. But, of course, it took some time, and when I look back at that experience, it's amazing how seamless that transition was. After being a student, after being at the bottom of these authoritarian systems, these domination systems for 16 years, how quickly I could move to the top side of that, right? Because if the entire world, when we become adults, same thing is true with politics, if the entire world looks like domination systems, and that's all there is, boy, you better get on the top. And none of this was ever conscious. It seemed right. Authority was the truth. And I was the authority. We had rules. We had procedures. It was about safety. So I apologize for that. I feel like I could apologize to a lot of kids for what I didn't realize in time throughout my career. But we were talking about these seeds because we started talking about these much younger kids. And with some of the tutoring I've been doing, I've been in and out of these elementary schools, a couple times a week. Some kids the schools have these end-of-the-day programs where, because parents usually work till 5, and some of the schools have figured out that it's good to have something for the kids to do from 3 to 5. So, you know, I can go right in and take a kid out of the after-school program and tutor them right in the school. That's convenient for everybody. But as I've walked through these halls in these schools, I've heard some amazing things. I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking I'm probably going to wind up saying something to somebody, to one of these adults. And I don't know what the best way to do that is. I don't know, should I say something in front of the kids? Would that make the kids uneasy? But I hear these things over and over again. What part of blank don't you understand? Big, physically giant adult talking to a physically small, you know, second, third, fourth grader. Do you need a lesson in standing in line? Says the big, physically big adult to the physically small child. I hear things like this. I hear those words, but what I really hear is that person saying, I am big, I am big, I am big, I am significant. And you are not. Now, one incident like that really might not make a difference in a young person's life, but if you sprinkle these seeds everywhere, and this process goes on for years and years and years, especially during those elementary years. Boy, won't high school make sense? And then won't all of these authoritarian systems and domination systems that we encounter in adulthood seem perfectly normal? I've been stunned by how little adults who work in education question anything that's going on. But even though this has been kind of a rant, and, you know, I hope you can mine it for something useful, I really believe that, you know, people go, many, many people go into this system with good intentions. A system makes them something else. But that doesn't mean because of the impact that this system has on people when they become adults that they don't go into it for the wrong reasons. They might go into it because they want to feel big. They want to feel significant because they think that the world can only be divided that way. Big and small, important, unimportant, significant, and insignificant. Decision maker, decision taker. I don't think people look at this profession as, oh, this is a place where I can feel really good about myself because I'll be in charge and I can bully kids. But that's what happens. So, seeds grow into stuff. And even though I could have presented these ideas with a little more clarity, for the last couple months I've looked at two very different educational environments. One with these very young kids. Now kids were treated with great respect at Scholars Academy. And, you know, even though it wasn't my ideal educational environment, I was really impressed with what I saw there versus what I had seen throughout my career in other places. But the treatment that I saw in the elementary school and a lot of the things that I saw these young kids trying to express, you know, this is how I feel, this is what I want, before they'd learned that it's not okay to feel and want things in that environment. It's not okay to break the mold. It's not okay to be an individual. But then, you know, maybe sometimes even within the same day, I go to work with a high school kid. And, oh, those wants and needs, they're not being expressed. And it's funny, like, if I have this 8-year-old kid, and this is a true story, I work with this 8-year-old kid, I can say one word, like mythology, archaeology, aliens, and he'll talk for an hour. And I'll learn things. But if I go to a kid twice his age, 17, 18 years old, and we're working on the college application process, and we're talking about writing an essay or filling out the Common App or something like that, what are you good at? What do you want to do? What's important to you? Where do you have some expertise? Silence. When asking a person questions about their own being, about their self, their wants, their needs, their desires, silence. And it's not just the school. I believe the parents contribute to this too. And I see a lot of that in this college application process, this college consulting that I do. Parents are very good at what I would call conditional encouragement. Right? Well, I will encourage you. I will put all my effort behind what you want to do, as long as it's what I want you to want to do. And so often we see that people are like robbed. These young people who are getting ready for college or finishing up high school, they're like robbed of even pondering what they want, because mom and dad are making the plan for them. How many times do we hear people say, these are things that I hear, and maybe you've heard them too. I'm gonna go to the Naval Academy, because that my dad was in the Navy. I'm gonna be a teacher because my mom was a teacher. I can get into the union because my uncle is in the union. I want to be the president because my dad was also the president. I don't know how to define it, and I don't think I fully understand the root cause, but I see it over and over and over again in so much of what I do. These people who are physically big, they are so terrified of, you know, people who are potentially big when it comes to ambition, when it comes to intellect, when it comes to creativity, individuality, and curiosity. And they use that physical size, they use that seniority to crush all of that other stuff into a fine, potentially human, potentially self-actualizing, potentially great powder. So we have this, I mean, we see how just ubiquitous this authoritarianism is. It's everywhere. And at the beginning of the Kids Are Not Defective series, I said the state is not something that's like external that we're fighting against. It's something that's inside of our psyche, of the way that most people look at the world, the way that most people think problems should be solved. It's a part of us. It's not separate from us. And in the very, very beginning of this show, like in the first episode, I said that School Sucks is a fine title for this program, because all of these attributes that we have that in so many ways seem to be innate. We're curious. We're reasonable. Individualistic and inventive. And that stuff gets sucked out of us. I hope what I'm describing here is just another empirical example of that. And if we want to, I mean, we don't have to say school sucks. We could say that school is a wall that we run into at some point in our lives, usually when we're very young. The family is a wall. Society is a wall. Our religious indoctrination, our exposure to those insane ideas is a wall that we run into when we're trying not to conform. Before we're taught that obedience is virtuous. And then we have to stop. You know, and politely find the door and ask to go through. To be what so many have decided is preferable and convenient, compliant, insignificant, and awaiting instructions. And it's, maybe this is repetitive, but this was significant for me because here I am seeing all of this stuff again, firsthand, you know, with this elementary school student in the morning and this high school student at night. It's like the whole process compacted into one day from my point of view. Seeing the beginning and then seeing the result. And we've talked about, you know, the terror of adults, the fear and the knee-jerk outrage and indignation that young people, or even somebody my age, might encounter when talking to old people. about some of these ideas, the ridicule. That's just fear. You know, these people are petrified. And I think that so many of them deep down know that a lot of the things that we're saying, you know, about the economy, about the political system, about education, about childhood, about families, is valid. Oh, but it's too much to face. It's easier just to ridicule and attack, right? To make younger people feel small and insignificant. And I've said before, when I first started presenting these ideas and I was met with these reactions, I would walk away from conversations with big people, and by bigger in this case I mean older, saying, you know, gosh, maybe I got it wrong. Maybe I have a lot to learn. Don't feel that way. If you've been listening to this show for, whatever, 80 episodes, if you are, you know, checking out some of the stuff that Steph does on YouTube or his podcast or Complete Liberty or Free Talk Live, you know, stop questioning yourself. Stop questioning these ideas. And I mean, we should always want to learn more. We should always want to be better. But don't feel like you're wrong. Don't feel like you're stupid. Don't feel like you're insignificant. Don't be dominated. You don't need to feel dominated. Especially by people who, in every way that really matters, are actually much smaller than you. So these seeds, they grow into, you know, something far more horrid than a teacher cutting off a kid's hair, you know, a kid being told to shut up, a kid being told, what part of stand still don't you understand? Oh, they get so much bigger and uglier than that. To be continued.
She's 7 years old, and this is the kind of thing that will scar her for life.
Now at 10, the story of a Milwaukee first grader is gaining national attention after her teacher cut off one of her braids in class as punishment.
12 News reporter Nick Bohr broke the story Friday, and since then, the little girl's plight has gone nationwide. Nick is live outside MPS headquarters, new at 10. And Nick, you've learned the teacher is still in the classroom.
Well, she is, Terry, though the little girl has been moved to a different class. Because it's a personnel matter, the MPS school district isn't saying much about any discipline that might be forthcoming.
I know things happen to kids every day. I didn't think it would get the attention that it's getting. But
Amaya's mom tells us tonight she was surprised at how many people have been critical of her for not getting physical with the teacher.
I don't want to teach my kids that violence is the answer. I'm a single mother of six kids. I don't want them to go out here every time somebody does something wrong and just start fighting. There's a better way to handle things.
Live at MPS headquarters, Nick Ford, WISN, 12 News.
Thanks, Nick. And teacher discipline has to be approved by the MPS board. The personnel committee did meet tonight. We asked them about any action, but the board tells us they haven't received any recommendations yet for discipline in the case.